Thank you for joining us on this journey to discover more about the English Riviera UNESCO Global Geopark, one of Earth's extraordinary places. In this series of interviews, our patron, Professor Ian Stewart, explores what it is that makes this geopark so special, from when the rocks around us were formed, to evidence of early humans, and right up to artists and writers who are being inspired by the geopark today.
Welcome everyone, welcome to the Focus on the Geopark, which is the regular podcast really looking at everything to do with the English Riviera UNESCO Global Geopark. And I'm a geologist, and so my interest from the geopark has always been about its ancient heritage, the rocks that lie along this fantastic piece of coastline. And actually, today's one, which we're going to talk about, the marine life, marine conservation, what we can actually see out there, to a large extent, is in the first place is predicated by this amazing, like, intricate geology, the intricate geology of these peninsulas and headlands jutting out and creating this lovely set of nested bays and inlets that's actually this great breeding ground, really, for this great diversity of life. And so what we've got is that we've got five people here representing different aspects of this amazing marine life. And I'll just bring them in individually. But I think, Jessica, if you could just say a little bit about what you do and also what you love about what's to be seen off the coast of the Torbay area. What is it for you that makes you love this area so much?
Thanks. Yeah. So I work as a marine planner for the Marine Management Organisation, also part of a number of volunteer groups in the Bay, including Torbay Cleaner Coast Initiative. And what I love about the Bay and what makes it special for me is being able to take a 20-minute stroll on the coast and seeing so much diversity of marine life, from guillemots through to gannets and seals through to harbour porpoises. And that is, you don't have to be a wildlife expert, you don't have to be stood there with binoculars or telescopes or anything like that. You can see it with the naked eye just from a walk up Berry Head, say, on the headland, and just look out over and appreciate these things on a daily basis.
And to what extent do you get a sense that people are appreciating that? I was over at Brixham the last weekend there, and it was packed, absolutely, you know, really rammed. And, you know, people were having their chips and eating their, you know, licking their ice cream and things like that. But I wonder how many of them that come through there are actually having some kind of connection to that amazing natural world. What's your take on it, Jessica?
Yeah, I think the information is out there and the connections are becoming more frequent. People are understanding where to go to see these things, how they can access it, how they can watch them and view them without causing any disturbance or disruption to the wildlife itself. And even a walk along the breakwater in Brixham or around the sort of harbour in Torquay, you get to see seals and seabirds that you otherwise, you know, wouldn't be able to get as close to. Or experience them just doing their natural behaviour.
I wanted to bring Warwick in, really, because you've got the best job in the world, haven't you, Warwick?
Tell us what you do. I have. I mean, I'm very lucky to, be able to live in this part of the world that Jess has just explained so very well, and also to be able to run a scuba diving rib out of Brixham Harbour, taking people out to see what wonders there are in Torbay under the water, as well as on, you know, dry land when we're in between dives. So I, as the skipper, get to see all the stuff on the surface, and they get to come and back up to the surface after their dive and tell me what they've seen underwater. And sometimes it is literally as stunning as everything you can see above water.
So how do you sell it then, Warwick? I mean, what do you say when what's your lines to get people to come on board and go out there?
Well, there's two big selling points for diving in Torbay. One is the geology, literally. It's a sheltered bay that faces east. And as has already been mentioned, you know, the prevailing weather conditions up until recent years anyway have always been from the west-southwest. So actually, when everyone else is blown out, for example, down in Plymouth, you can very often get some really good diving in Tor Bay without going too far offshore. So that's one of the big selling points for it. And also, it's you can get access to relatively deep water very close to the shore. I mean, for example, everyone who's you know, on dry land, Jess has just mentioned Berry Head. If you stand on the top of Berry Head and look down, if you could see the seabed, not even 100 metres off Berry Head, you would be able to see as far again down to the seabed. So, you know, you've got a sort of 40, 50 metre drop off just 100 yards off the shore of Berry Head, which is, of course, is so popular with some of the marine mammals, particularly the cetaceans, the whales, dolphins and porpoise that we've heard about. They come really, really close to the shore at Berry Head. And that sort of geology and topography of the bay is all around the bay as well. I mean, for example, the caves and caverns that everyone would be familiar with at Kent's Cavern, for example, they exist under Berry Head, and it's actually possible to swim through Berry Head in one area from one side to the other, not very far. It sounds more dramatic than it is. And likewise, you're able to swim through the Allstone from one side to the other because of the geology of the folds in the rocks. So everything you can sort of see on dry land is almost replicated underwater as well. Big cliffs, caverns, caves, you know, reefs, on which all the marine life grows and loves it.
You've just reminded me that I did the first part of my paddy in Plymouth, but we couldn't do it in Plymouth. We had to come across to Brixham to do the first bit. But I finished it off in Plymouth with visibility less than a metre. So there's a very good point there about that clarity of the water. And Duncan, that clarity must be one of the... Tell us what you do and your connection here, because you're you dive there.
Yeah, so I manage or co-manage the SEAL Project, small conservation charity that is... promotes the protection of grey seals in the area. So we've got a survey boat that covers 40 kilometres, so from Dawlish to Gainswear, but we focus predominantly within the bay. And what we've got in the bay is we've got a transient seal population, which is all year round. So we're just at the beginning of pupping season. So we would expect in the coming months to see a lot more seal activity in Tor Bay, which is a really exciting time of year. For us especially. So because of the huge range of biodiversity, seals are actually very happy here. And we are seeing year on year an increase in the amount of seals visiting and passing through Tor Bay. Now that's not to say that the seal numbers in the UK are increasing exponentially, but they are moving certainly. So we haven't quite worked out yet exactly why they're moving. We think it's food related, but we are seeing more seals in this region, which shows us that our waters are rich and fertile and a really good habitat for grey seals.
And so, you know, it's amazing having the realization of just how busy that stretch of coastline is in terms of the human connection, that the seals are such a dominant factor. That seems incredible.
It is. It's fascinating for us as researchers with regard to kind of seal ethology. Analysing the human impact factors is always going to be of interest to conservationists. And what we've got in Tor Bay, fortunately, is we've got stretches of intense human activity, but we've also got really lovely pockets of wild space. So places where humans don't go so much, like the small little coves and the caves and the shore between kind of Kingswear and Tor Bay, but also around Seven Croix area. So actually there are places where these wild mammals can go. But ultimately, there's always going to be a balance there. So we are kind of monitoring why and how the seal activity is developing and moving in this region. It's just the volume and the beauty of our marine life that I see on a daily basis is astounding, absolutely astounding.
So I want to bring in Claire there, because Claire, I mean, it is the most diverse marine. We're starting to get a sense, really, of just how diverse a coastal marine habitat it is. Tell us about your role and what your take on this is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I'm actually working for the Wild Planet Trust. It's a conservation charity very much focused on conservation in the UK and abroad. But here in Torbay, we've got the most beautiful bay, the most beautiful scenery. We have lots of tourists here who come to admire the bay. And one of the things we've been working on over the last few years is actually the thing that people don't see when they visit, and that's the seagrass beds underneath the surface of the bay. There is an underwater forest in Torbay that a lot of people, when they're out swimming, might get a little bit tangled around their feet at a low tide, but otherwise don't tend to notice. It's the only marine flowering plant, a grass, it's been in the bay for thousands, millions of years. As you were talking about the geology, the seagrass is actually a historic part of Torbay.
If someone wanted to see that really well, where's the best place for them to go and immerse themselves in the seagrass, then, Claire?
Yeah, so you'd need to speak to Warwick and go out on his dive boat. You really do need to dive. You can snorkel at low tide, actually. On Tor Abbey, which is one of the busiest tourist beaches, on a very low tide, you will see little bits of the seagrass exposed, just the edges of it. But yeah, the best way to see it is actually to dive, and scuba is the best way, or you can snorkel if you're pretty proficient at it.
Well, I'll come back to maybe how the seagrass, why it's so important with Claire in a second, but I'm just, Warwick, tell us about the seagrass for you. You've been highlighted as the gateway to the seagrass there.
Yes, I mean, I do support the local seagrass conservation project, as has been said already, and through that I've got a pretty good eye now on where the densest patches are. My personal take on it is probably Torbay hundreds of years ago, as Claire was just saying, was probably covered in it from shore to shore right across the bay, because it's got that, it's relatively shallow until you get well outside the bay, and therefore it gets good sunlight, and that's what the seagrass needs to really thrive. And in places where it has never been, you know, sort of trawled or dredged or anything like that, you can see it's almost like a mangrove swamp really close up to the shore. So Tor Abbey Sands is a good place to see it. There's a small bed just off Brixham Breakwater Beach. There's a smaller bed as well off Fishcombe Cove. So some of these little isolated coves where people can't get to very easily are some of the best and most dense seagrass beds that you can see today, because of the reasons Duncan was just saying. There's not too much human activity there to sort of degrade them any further. Elbury Cove is another good one, but that is very popular with holidaymakers and visitors and tourists and yachties, jet skiers, water skiers, and all the rest of it. But yes, you don't need to be able to dive. If you are a proficient snorkeler, as Claire has already said, you can actually free dive down to the seagrass beds and get a good idea of what lives there. But to really appreciate it, you need to spend some quiet, chilled out time down there, not moving very fast, especially if you want to see an elusive seahorse. In all 33 years of my UK diving career, I've never seen one. But there you go. I live in hope. hope.
I was just wanting to go back to Claire about the importance of seagrass. Tell us why seagrass is so important.
Yeah, I mean, it's got many important aspects to it, really. The first is for biodiversity. So where seagrass beds are found, the biodiversity is much greater, than would be a sandy, sedimented seabed. Also, it's really good at stabilising that seabed. It's a grass, it's got rhizomes, so it forms a mat, and it actually stabilises the seabed and creates a nice sheltered space for animals living there. And, you know, Brixham, as people know, is a big fishery, and seagrass is really important for those commercial fisheries. things like pollock and sea bass and cuttlefish, they all spawn, and the young use it as a nursery ground. So yeah, really, really important. And also it's a carbon sink as well. It's something that a lot of people don't think about. It's actually twice as efficient as the rainforest per square meter. So yeah, it's really important, and you know, it's there, and it's on our doorstep. And you know, if we can protect it and increase the extent of the seagrass, which is one of the things that we're trying to identify and work with the MMO and the Inshore Fisheries Conservation Agency to make sure that we do, you know, enhance the state of that seagrass bed and allow it to actually regenerate and grow.
And is that, how hard is that? Maybe I don't know if Jessica or Duncan want to come in as well, but how hard is it to actually increase for that sequestration rule? Is it easy to increase the extent of the seagrass, or is it just kind of preserve what's there?
Yeah, so preserving it is the first thing, obviously, but being able to stop activities that are actually going to cause it harm. So the first thing, as Warwick said, was to actually stop the dredging in those areas, and that stopped with the Marine Conservation Zone designation in 2013. So that was a great benefit to the seagrass beds, without a doubt. But the other thing is anchoring of pleasure craft, and something that the Wild Planet Trust has been involved in, along with other organisations, is trialling some eco-friendly moorings to prevent anchoring and prevent scour of moorings, traditional moorings. And we've actually had some real good success in the Shelter Bay in Tor Bay.
Anyone else want to come in on the seagrass there, Jessica or Duncan, in terms of your experience with it? Yeah, thanks.
I think the other important aspect of seagrass is because many people don't even realise it's there. So it's about raising awareness of the habitats that are underwater and how they need protecting. So it's about education, getting the message out, being clear in, whatever sort of whatever resources are used to help prevent damage to the seagrass, being clear on what that is and why we're doing it. And just to promote that message, really. So we use a lot of social media through Tor Bay Cleaner Coast Initiative to try and make people aware of the seagrass bed, aware of the importance of it, and also aware of how they can do their bit to help protect it.
Is that a habitat for the seals, Duncan?
Absolutely. I mean, it's because they're in sheltered waters and shallow waters, it's areas where you often find seals, like Cherston Cove and Fishcombe Cove are great examples for that. The seals, it's on their feeding route, and they use it for a bit of a shelter, so they can go in there and bottle and sleep and rest, but they can also socialise in there as well. So when, mainly in the winter, post-pupping season that is upon us now, is you'll see groups of 6, 7, 8, 9 seals at a time, early morning, in there when there's no humans around. And actually, that's a really beautiful thing, and it just shows the incredible importance of these coves, not just for the seagrass, but for all species.
I wanted to ask about the marine conservation areas and to what extent that piece of magnificent coastline is protected. I mean, Claire, could you say a little bit about what extent is actually covered by marine conservation and how recently it's come through and evolved?
Yeah, so the Marine Conservation Zone was actually designated in 2013, which was great news for Tor Bay. There is a lot of community support for protection of wildlife in the bay, but it was good to get that actual designation. And we are part of a European designation as well, a special area of conservation. And of course, we have the geopark designation. So the whole area really is incredibly important. The one thing that we have to do, though, is to make sure that it is being protected and people understand the importance of the bay and why some activities could be potentially dangerous.
Sorry, Claire. Is it the whole bay?
It's not. It's So you can't just draw a line across. It's actually, I don't have a map to show you. It's actually quite complex the way it's designated, but probably Jess could explain a bit more about that.
Yeah, Jess, please. I'm just curious as how extensive it was.
There's a number of habitats in the bay and also the surrounding area, and a huge amount of Lyme Bay, of which Tor Bay is part of. So, there's a number of marine protected areas sort of surrounding us for various reasons, and they're designated for different species. And very recently we've had a big area surrounding Tor Bay designated for harbour porpoise protection. So it's really important that when we're sort of, again, promoting the conservation of marine species and how to protect them and how to view them and things, that we do make reference to these marine protected areas and the features that they're protected for and why. Although you can see a huge array of wildlife from the coast in Tor Bay, you can't see always what's underwater unless you are able to dive and snorkel and wild swim. And it's really important to get that message out to people who, you know, don't often visit the coast and the seaside and, you know, aren't aware of what's out there.
And I'm guessing that for most people, the problem, the education bit of telling people is those that engage most closely with that marine realm. So the boat owners and the casual, the people that just come down and are not really kind of intimately connected with it. I mean, is that a problem of the sheer usage of that stretch of coastline? Claire, you're nodding away.
Yeah, I mean, it's a busy coastline and there's so many different users. You've got your tourists, you've got your harbour, you've got your cruise liners, you've got the fishing industry, and many, many more. So there's many marine users. So, and the wildlife is very much part of that and living in that area. So it's really important to protect that. Through the Seagrass Project, we've done a lot of work going out to schools. So starting at the young age and actually telling them about the seagrass habitat and the bay and how important it is to protect it. And then working with the Harbour Authority. So they have an app when the people come in to visit the bay in their yachts and their boats. It just pops up on the app and it tells them where the seagrass beds are. And it tells them more about it. So finding different ways to tell people about it is really, really important. And I know that's what Duncan does with his SEAL project as well, is going out to the local community. And the more the local community know, the more that they'll tell the visitors.
Duncan, do you want to pick up on that in terms of your
One of our, on top of the data collection, the sciencey stuff about what seals are visiting and why and how, one of our main focuses as a conservation charity focusing on seals is that of communication. Yeah. And we are all year round. So although we've got an increased activity this time of year, being in the summer, our communication message is not just to the community, but to the tourists as well. And that's a really tricky role, to be able to connect with people that are only here for a very short time. So we are, community-wise, we are, as Claire said, doing educational programs in schools covering all ages, working within the community on a number of different awareness campaigns and projects. Promoting the seagrass beds is another one of ours as well. And during the summer, when we've got visiting tourists, we are as visible and as vocal as we can be about all marine conservation. Yeah. Because we've all got all the groups, whether it be the SEAL project or the Seagrass Initiative or Operation Cetacean, all these various different operations that promote conservation of specific species and habitats. If we all share that message, the same message, we can reach a bigger audience. And we have seen successes this year specifically in those areas.
And that's great. And another part, another dimension to this conservation preservation is kind of reducing marine litter. And Warwick, I know you've been involved, several of you involved in the Cleaner Coast initiative. Can someone kind of tell me a little bit, Warwick, tell me a little bit about the Cleaner Coast initiative?
Yes, I mean, it's relatively new, but as Claire and Jess have already said, its genesis really was from a project that's been ongoing in the Bay for many, many years now. We just decided to rename it to the Tor Bay Cleaner Coast Initiative to better reflect what the current problem was. And and that really, it was born, I suppose, of a number of people noticing that the amount of litter and rubbish that was both discarded, abandoned, lost, or otherwise found itself both onto the shoreline and indeed underwater was seemed to be increasing. But I think that is a global problem that we're all well aware of now, and it's certainly a national problem, and there are certain hotspots. And because Torbay is so busy with both the commercial industries of the bay and also the tourists, as well as the ordinary leisure pleasure public, you know, residents who just like to enjoy themselves by the coast of the weekends, why shouldn't they? It is a lovely place. The message needs to be got out there, as Duncan has said, that this is also a very, very important habitat for multiple marine life species, both coastal and on and in under the water. And I don't think even some locals realise that, you know, modern packaging, modern plastic products, as cheap and disposable as they are capable of causing so much damage if just left discarded on the beach, because as we all know, they're very robust, they last forever, takes ages for them to break up, and the jury's out on whether they ever break down. So I suppose we noticed an increase in the levels, so we just formed a local group of collaborative partnerships to organize community run beach cleans. So it's the good people of Torbay that come together. We just do the organization, provide the equipment, the insurance cover and all that sort of thing. And then roughly once a month, we organize a coastal cleanup. Sometimes there's diving involved. That's where I sort of come in on my day job side of life, where we pick a particular hotspot and we also clean up what's on the seabed. But basically, we try and organise one a month. And as Duncan was just saying, all year round, not just in the summer months, sometimes the winter is more important because of the impact of storms and heavy weather blowing into the bay from the east particularly. Torbay has this unfortunate geography again in this particular case of acting like a collecting bucket when it comes in from the east. And we have literally, cleared tons, and I mean tons, metric tons of, since I would say 2017, I think we've waded in, Jess, haven't we? And it's something like 5.5-6 tons, metric tons of mainly plastic has been cleared off Torbay's beaches. So, and that's all with, you know, with a little bit of organisation from Torbay Cleaner Coast Initiative, but mainly the goodwill, elbow grease and efforts of the general public of Torbay, and including some visitors who just happen to be here when they come down to visit a beach and see us all operating down there, and they'll join in. You don't need to book on. You can just turn up, see one of the organisers, get a pair of gloves and a litter picker and a bag, and off you go. So it's been very successful, very successful.
I have this vision of the Torquay garbage patch there. But, you know, that geology, that it's creating these nice little microclimates. It's also creating these little patches. But Jess, you've obviously been heavily involved in this too. What makes it important for you?
Yeah, I've always been very passionate about marine litter and marine conservation, and have been involved with surveying marine litter on a beach in Brixham for a number of years, and that data went to OSPAR to help them to understand better what was happening with marine litter and how the levels were increasing and what types of marine litter were being found and where the marine litter is coming from. So all of that data has then helped for OSPAR to drive the marine strategy and for the UK to adopt the marine strategy and for us to have now targets and expectations on reducing the marine litter around our shores. So it's something we're really passionate about. And we don't just do beach cleans, so we're really heavily involved in motivating other people to make change, to reduce their plastic use. We've also been massively involved in helping the commercial fishing sector of Brixham and the Southwest to recycle their commercial nets. And we helped to establish that project in the port of Brixham, which was a huge undertaking and very, very successful. And we have removed rubble from the sea, from a kiosk that was washed into the sea in Storm Emma. We rally the troops immediately after a storm and organise what we can to help, you know, deal with those easterlies and what they bring into Torbay. And again, the volunteers of Torbay are amazing, and it's a lovely network of people that we have that participate in our cleans, but also talk to us on social media and get involved in our campaigns and what we're trying to do.
And Duncan, how does a letter affect the seals then? Is there a direct influence there?
Absolutely. And it's not just seals, but I can talk on behalf of the seals briefly. Entanglement is a real concern for the seals and for us trying to protect them. If an animal becomes entangled in something, a substance like plastic, be it net or angling line, then that angling line is going to be there for a long period of time. It is an increasing problem as activity grows around our shores and biodiversity succeeds, then you're going to see more of this. So the amount of litter discarded through domestic litter as well as commercial litter needs to be addressed more and more. So we've got more of an active role as conservationists to monitor and influence human activity and behaviour in order to protect the species. And we've had an increase this year of entanglements in seals, more so, but partly, as we were discussing briefly earlier, that's partly to do with the fact that we are louder about our message, so more people can reach us now. So there has been an increase in reporting with that as well, of course.
And I guess more seals, which was another a good thing.
Absolutely.
With the bigger increases in number of seals, we're going to get more of that. But it sounds like from collectively, there is a, it's almost like, there's a real awareness of the problem, and that by and large, there is, given the competition of different uses for that marine space, that by and large, it's relatively well managed. Would you say that, Claire, or anyone else want to jump in? Claire, what do you take? How much more effort do we need in this area of trying to manage these different uses?
Yeah, it does take a lot of effort, and it takes a lot of passion, and there's a lot of passionate people, as you can tell, which helps to drive that forward, which is absolutely great. And we do have a really great community here in Torbay. We can always make it better. We can always improve. But we have been fortunate over the years to build up a really good network within Torbay and have, you know, the majority of those marine users involved in talking to us and communicating with us and being able to, you know, share those problems and find solutions to those problems. And yeah, Torbay Cleaner Coast Initiative have made a real impact within Torbay as far as litter is concerned. But it's a bigger picture, and we need to carry on that message.
I wanted to kind of go around, around the screen, really, in terms of getting a feeling of sort of the best experiences or the most amazing experiences you've had out there, because the reason you do it isn't the reason you go and collect litter and things like that isn't because you love to collect litter, it's because you've seen these worlds that are out there. Jess, or in terms of your one, what's a standout either places or experiences that you've had that you just think is unbelievable?
So one recently this year in particular was quite memorable for me. I was down at Berryhead Quarry talking to a group of visiting anglers that were there fishing, and we have had a few issues with the litter levels down there and also people camping, having fires and things like that. So it's about raising awareness with these visiting anglers that, you know, what you can and can't do or shouldn't do in these areas, and also trying to support them to take their litter home, to understand the impacts of litter on wildlife. So whilst having these conversations with a group of visiting anglers, there was a huge pod of common dolphins then came past Berryhead, obviously feeding very quick. They were leaping out of the water. They were very, very visible, and they got closer and closer, and it was just an amazing experience, and one that everybody that was there just stopped to appreciate and take photos and just savour the moment, really. So yeah, it was very touching, and it really helped to get across the message of you know, how we should respect our marine life.
And that interconnectedness between the different realms. Claire, what about you? What's your standout reminiscence?
Yeah, so I'm so fortunate to live and work right on the coast, so I can see the sea view pretty much 24/7, and I walk the coast every day. I love the change in the seasons, the change in the weather, seeing something different every day. There's always something to see. But for me, it's sharing that experience and teaching students. I've taught many students over the years, doing seashore surveys, rock pools. I love having my nose in a rock pool and seeing the life in there. The rock pools around here are teeming with life, and being able to share that and show students and then see them actually, start loving and appreciating the coast because of it. And the most special moment I've had, I guess, in the bay was swimming off of Broadsands, shoaling fish beneath me and gannets diving. Wow. Around me. Amazing.
That's extraordinary. Yeah. Duncan, what about you?
Well, two aspects, really. The first aspect really is my own personal experiences, and one very recently, a couple of weeks ago, where I was at St Mary's, literally just on the other side of Bury Head. And my colleague who I was swimming with had gone into the beach to get a new battery for his camera or whatever it was. And I was left alone by this big rock area, and this seal came up and just nudged me from behind. And it was a female juvenile seal. And she was absolutely incredible. And she was showing very relaxed, playful behavior. And she shared that moment with me for about 5 minutes until my colleague came back and then went, well, don't want this anymore. And off she went again. But I had those moments, and I caught a lot of it on film, and it was just incredible. It was a real special, precious moment. But in addition to that, what I really love to see, and really gets me going, is other people's reactions to wildlife. And I see it all the time. I spend a lot of time observing seals and other species. And often we're introducing the seals to people, because there can be a seal hauled out on the rocks and people are milling around doing their touristy thing and don't know it's there until you point it out for the protection of the seal. Yeah. And their response and reaction to see the seal in the flesh for the first time is magical. Same as if you see a whale in the wild or a dolphin in the wild. There's something that triggers the happiness in someone when that happens. And to see that is just pure beauty.
Fantastic. I mean, Warwick, you must see that pretty regularly.
Yeah.
I mean, Duncan's right. I mean, if I had to put my number one experience of the bay since I've lived down here, it has been stood on the top of Bury Head. To be honest with you, nothing to do with diving and seeing a humpback whale breaching, pectoral fin slapping for about an hour and a half. I just don't honestly know where else in the world you could have gone and had that length of experience without having to go on a boat.
When did that happen?
I think it was 2017. Wow. The humpback, it was the famous one that got tangled in the fisherman's pots off Slapton Sands a couple of times. Right. But that didn't seem to deter it. It seemed to be that comfortable with coming close inshore that all of a sudden it appeared in the bay. Everyone else sadly had to go back to work on Monday morning. It was a lovely crisp Monday morning. I think it was January, February, sort of March time. So quite early in the year. And I just thought, I wonder if it's still around. And I went up Bury Head. There was all manner of people up there, loads of people with cameras and all the rest of it. But you didn't need a camera even. You could just look over the edge of Bury Head. And there it was, several hundred meters away from you. Awesome. I mean, awesome. Comments were being made by people. You could go to New Zealand, you could pay a load of dollars to go on a wildlife watching boat and probably not see anything. Yeah. And I saw it just stood in my hometown, if you like, looking off the edge of Bury Head. So that was probably my number one. My numbers two and three, I suppose, are underwater related. And really, the first one is involving the species that Duncan looks after so much, and that is the grey seals. I mean, they're not notorious for being friendly, not like the Farne Islands and, the ones off the Scillies and even on Lundy Island here in Devon. They're quite friendly, and for most of a dive, they will come and spend time with you and get right up close and personal in your grill, try and, nibble your fins and touch your face mask and get right up in your grill, as I say, with their whiskers in your face. Ours aren't like that. And so when one chooses to come into your space and trust you and have a close personal interaction, I had one just on a shore dive off Breakwater Beach in Brixham. It just decided it wanted some company. It chose to seek me out. And for about 20 minutes of this dive, this young female grey seal wouldn't leave me alone. Must be my male charm or something, I don't know. But it was just a beautiful experience because it was shy, but it wanted to interact with me, you know. And that was just a special experience. And again, I've done many, many dives. I've even gone out on dives where you've been promised you will see seals and they will interact with you, and seen absolutely nothing. And there I was, not expecting it. And it's a relatively common experience here in Brixham, despite how busy it is. As Duncan was saying, the fact the seals are choosing to congregate here in large numbers and seem comfortable around us, that is quite a special thing that the Bay's got going for it, as long as we reciprocate and we don't put too many hazards in their way in return. And then finally, I suppose, Ian, it's just, again, the topography and the geology of the Bay and the fact that in relatively shallow water, because of the limestone, it's porous and it's got fissures and caves and caverns under the water. So looking at another underwater experience for me, it's just the sheer volume of soft corals, sponges. Again, Duncan was alluding to it there, and that is trying to introduce the public to the wildlife of the Bay. And on shore, when you come out from a dive, still dripping wet, they will often say to you, the non-diving public, visitors and residents alike, what is there to see down there? It looks dark green, murky, horrible. If you're lucky enough that you've been diving with a camera and you can show them the pictures with a good flash, and hopefully some of that will come out in Dan's pictures that he's going to share with us for this project. The sheer colour of some of these anemones, sea squirts, sponges, soft corals is just mind-blowing. It really is. And they're almost wall-to-wall down there because the limestone seems to provide a really, really good habitat and an anchor point for this stuff to burrow into and get a good hold fast on.
Well, listen, if that those last few minutes haven't convinced any person listening to want to get not just get down to the beach and look out, but actually get on a boat or get on one of the dive units that you guys run and get underneath the water to see it, I don't know what will. So it's been an absolute pleasure listening to you. Thank you very much, Duncan, Claire, Jess, and Warwick. And if you're down this way, make sure you see under the water as much as you see above the water. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.